This is the Thai Capital Millionaire Podcast, episode 25. My name is Charles Oglesby, also known as Todd Millionaire. I'm the founder and the director of the Todd Capital Investment Club that now has 140 members, Todd Acquisitions, which is our real estate arm, and Todd Ventures, our crowdfunded venture capital firm. Thank you all for tuning in. The purpose of this podcast is to share the stories of successful African-American investors and business owners so that people can see that business and investing are the true keys to financial success and generational wealth. Last week, we had Lisa Phillips on the show, and I actually came across Al Williamson, who's our guest today, through her site. And I was definitely inspired by his story, inspired by the fact that he's willing to take on a lot of rentals and areas and properties where a lot of people kind of avoid. But I think there's a huge opportunity there. And he's showing that it's not only an opportunity, but it's possible to be successful there as well. So with that, I would like to welcome Mr. Williamson to the show.
I'm so pleased to be here. Thank you.
Very cool. So
thank you. That intro was great. Very enlightened thoughts that you're working with.
Thank you. So can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your professional background?
I sure can. You might hear my kids in the background because I'm home now, working from home. Mm-hmm. So I'm a family man now most of the time. Two kids. Married 21 years, pretty soon. Civil engineer by training, with a couple of engineering degrees. Way back in 90, I got out in 94 graduate school.
Wow.
In Champaign, Urbana. And now, you know, I did consulting engineering, nonprofit work, some state, federal engineering projects. For the past 20 years or so, and it got to the point where I could work for myself. So now I'm full-time landlord scientist. That's my job description now.
That's cool. It's funny because I just recently read your book, and so I know a little bit about you, but it's important that the guests really get your background. And it's cool because I think that you kind of like emphasized a lot of your civil engineering background in your real estate investing.
Yeah, that's right. There's you know, the thing about engineering, or actually real estate, is that you can bend it so that you can apply your strengths to it and do just fine and create a unfair advantage for yourself. So being a civil engineer in an area that a lot of civil engineers aren't operating, gives me the advantage. So absolutely, I apply all those different ways of thinking and, you know, different vantage points of how I attack a problem. I'll go at it that way. And it's just like Michael Jordan off the dribble. I can make my way around him.
Very cool. So in regard to real estate, when did you decide that you wanted to start kind of delving into investing in real estate?
You know, that happened at a church picnic just after I got engaged to my wife back in 96. A guy pulled me aside and he was asking me what my plans were. And we were planning on getting a house. My wife was just graduated from nursing school, and I was a civil engineer, so we were going to get a house. And he encouraged us to get a duplex. Mm-hmm. And look into that, you know, live on one side, rent the other side. And after that discussion with him, I hit the library and just worked my way across the library books, reading just about everything I could get my hands on to see if we could pull it off. And it made a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. So we started looking for fourplexes, but ended up with a threeplex that we... after we got married, we moved into one of the smaller units of that threeplex. So that's really how it was. It was a tip because no one in my family was doing rental properties at the time.
So you mentioned that your wife was a part of this decision. How did you get your wife on board? Because, I mean, a lot of times the wife, she wants the dream home.
Oh, yeah. That was the case. And that was the case. It was some fast talking on my part, you know. It was wasn't always comfortable. Her being, she said, "We're in an apartment, even though we own the whole joint.
Yeah,
we're in an apartment, you know." And you know, it was tough. It was tough treading for about 4 years until the property quadrupled in value.
Oh wow!
Then she. Then it was all right. It's all right. So I got her into a house as soon as I could.
Yeah.
I got her into a house. Yeah. We moved out of our unit and bought a little house and rented out our space.
And did you guys still hold on to that initial property, the fourplex or the threeplex?
No, that was our first 1031 exchange, nice. A tax-free exchange. And we got into an investment. That was doing really well at the time. It allowed us to bring in enough money to retire her.
Wow.
So we didn't need our income. Yeah.
That's awesome.
So we were like a 3% ownership in this big institutional investment. So that worked out. Yeah.
That's very cool. And so, I mean, do you think that had you guys not went that route in the beginning, and instead went and bought the dream house and then attached that home and the income that was required to pay for that home to both of your working incomes, do you think that you'll be able to kind of have been where you are now? Or do you think that just making that initial sacrifice in the beginning did pay off and did allow you guys to do all the great things you're doing now?
Yeah, that initial sacrifice and being in a emerging market, you know, it was a inner city play. That turned into, you know, it's just outside of downtown, turned into called, rebranded itself as Midtown, and prices swelled. That really opened my eyes to this whole redevelopment thing.
Yeah.
And what a neighborhood could do if it turned the corner and you happen to be in an ownership position. You know, that's what creates this disproportional amount of wealth for you. And again, you know, other people are paying your mortgage down, allowing you to hold on to the property. So it has all kinds of advantages, from tax laws being written for people who own assets to saving you out of pocket, reducing your personal expenses as well.
Yeah.
So it definitely was a great way of going, great path.
That's one thing I always tell people. I say that, like, revitalization and what some people might call gentrification isn't completely bad when you own the property there.
So, it tends to, yeah, you're on the right side of it. And, so, you know, I have a lot to say about that. But, you know, because oftentimes African Americans in general in these well strategically placed neighborhoods, you know, compared to all the transportation nodes and everything in proximity to the most vibrant parts of the community, even though their neighborhood's not vibrant, they know everything that's moving around. They have the inside knowledge. It's just, they're just not monetizing it.
Yeah.
And that's kind of why I'm on a little mission to make sure I get that message out of how to monetize that information.
That's good. I think that it was you who told, or in the book that I recently read that you wrote, and you said something along the lines of, like, you just go and you talk to people in the neighborhood. You can find out about who did what and when just by talking to the neighbors, because they just know and they just sit around and watch.
That's it. They know. You know, you find Big Mama or whoever is kind of the, you know, I'm talking about the mayor on the block, you know, who's the most influential person who's been, you know, raised all the troublemakers in the neighborhood. So you go to her and get her on your side, and you apply those leadership principles on influence. And that's how you have the unfair advantage versus, you know, those people who are just pouring money at it or come out with some workshop that they want everyone to leave their homes and come to. You know, being not afraid of those other people and speaking to them with the right amount of respect, and that's everything.
Yeah.
It opens all the doors up.
And that book that you wrote is called Building Wealth with Inner City Riddles. It's not super long, but it's definitely big on the content and the substance. I learned a lot. I learned that it's definitely possible to go into those neighborhoods and turn them around.
Good. That's exactly what my hope was to leave some breadcrumbs so that some other people can follow me up. You know, there's no success without a successor. Mm-hmm. And I wrote that book just before my neighborhood really blew up. It was kind of in the lag phase. You understand what I'm saying? We're working our way through the lag phase. Mm-hmm. And I was able to piece it all together. And now, you know, people are bidding, you know, $50,000 over asking prices for that neighborhood now. And it's rebranded itself. And people call me lucky that I'm there. Now all of a sudden I'm lucky. But looking back at it, what I wrote is more true than ever. You know, it's been, what I wrote that in 94, 95? No, 2014? 2011, I think I wrote that.
It says the copyright is 2013, so it's probably
2013. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, since then my neighborhood is just, you know, it's just skyrocketed in value and in demand. Mm-hmm. The demand for the neighborhood has just skyrocketed. And so I'm in that catalyzed stage. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm feeling like that now. So it's very accurate book. Yeah. It holds up over the period of time and across the nation as I've shared it with different people.
Yeah, I've already shared it with a few people. People are saying, like, what books do you recommend? Everybody knows I'm a big reader. So they'll say, like, what books do you recommend on gentrification? And so I'll say, like, just read this one. It's probably the only one that I've read that is actually from, like, African-Americans' point of view to kind of still capitalize on what's to come. Because in South L.A., we're looking at it right now. If you look at South L.A., you have all these areas. You have West L.A., you have the South Bay, you have downtown, you have Beverly Hills. And you have this nugget in the middle, which is, like, South L.A. And it's just prime for redevelopment. And so it's going to happen. It would be great if we just got in there and we were able to participate in what's going to happen by using the techniques that you outlined here. It's like, somebody said recently, like, what can be done for African-American people should be done by African-American people so that, like, we can benefit on the enhancements. It's going to come. We might as well profit on it. So to circle back to your first deal, just because I know a lot of people are still newbies out there, how did you get over your fear of doing that first deal?
Well, you know, I was scared. I kept reading different books I could get my hands on until I was reading the same thing over and over again. Then mm-hmm. Once I got that, I'm like, okay, I've convinced myself that I know enough to move forward, but you're still scared.
Yeah.
And that's with every stage that you go through, you gotta be willing to be vulnerable and not know what you're doing. And that's not comfortable. And you gotta, that's a great quote that what you want is outside of your comfort zone. Mm-hmm. The things that you really want. And after you get there, then you look back on it and you're like, oh, that was just a little bit of stretch. It wasn't as scary as I thought it ought to be. And, you know, the white man didn't come and knock me down, smoke me, or, mm-hmm. you know, all those, we're our own worst bullies in our brains.
Yeah.
Once we can settle that part, that inner talk, we can move forward.
On that first deal, was there any rehab, or was it all pretty much turnkey?
Yeah, there was some. There was a little bit of rehab. Nothing major. It was a good looking Victorian threeplex. You know, 1890 had all kinds of gingerbread details on it, and it was well painted and well loved. But I'm an engineer, so I want to go and make sure historical things are working and bring out the charm in it. Mm-hmm. And that's another powerful thing about real estate is that you can bring out the historical, shine up the historical features of it. Mm-hmm. to bring out the value in it, or to create people, make people love it. Mm-hmm. Because they see those features on it. So that's all kinds of wealth building subliminal techniques there with connecting with people on those emotional levels.
Yeah, I think that that's one thing we're looking at with the property that we're about to acquire is that, like, with real estate, you do have way more control than stocks. And so we can control the amount of rehab we do. We can control how we rehab. We can control what color we paint it. But with stocks, you just take it as it is. Either it's going to perform or it's not going to perform, but you don't have any say-so. So I think that's really cool. I had a question. Oh, my question is that there's this quote that says that you have to go as far as you can see, and then when you get there, you'll see further. And so can you talk about how maybe this happened or didn't happen, how the world kind of opened up to you after you were completed, after you were successful with that first triplex deal? Like, did you feel any different at that point than you did before you started investing? Were you more gutsy? Can you kind of talk about how the world opened up at that point?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So I guess I was going through a lot of phases. You know, when you're early, you know, your early 20s, you think about accomplishments and your grades and everything like that. Then later on, it becomes the money becomes a big thing that you want. And then as you grow older, it's family becomes a big thing. That's your main priority. And then your legacy. That's kind of how most people see the cycle. I was in the phase of money. Mm-hmm. So I was just focused on that. I wanted to go buy up everything, become a millionaire. But that, you know, that first event, it was a blessing that it quadrupled on me. Mm-hmm. And equity on paper wise, I became a millionaire. Nice. And I realized that I didn't help anybody. Mm. it was an empty feeling. Mm-hmm. You know, and it would happen because just the circumstances that I didn't create, I just benefit from those things. Mm-hmm. So it was an accomplishment financially, but I realized I needed to have meaning attached to my wealth building.
Yeah.
So that's what really shaped me right there.
That's good. And so then where did you go from there?
After that one, you know, we bought the 8-unit building. I was in the most troubled part of this neighborhood that I decided to focus on. I saw the benefits of what a neighborhood revitalization could do.
Wow.
I said, I want to start from the beginning. Yeah. and usher this thing through and try to get as many people on board, see if I can talk more people into participating. Just like you were just talking about your South LA.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can see it already. You see it's going to happen whether you participate in it or not.
Mm-hmm.
Because it can't not happen because it's all the forces on all the sides. You know, I guess we're hunters. We can anticipate where to throw the spear, you know, before the rabbit gets mm-hmm. there, you know. So we can anticipate. So I wanted to see if I could convince as many people as I wasn't successful in getting anyone else to come with me. Actually, yeah. It's just my ride.
Yeah,
and that was unfortunate. Now that I've done it,
it's unfortunate for them for not hopping on. It sounds like,
yeah. Well, you know, everyone is doing the best with the information they had. I didn't have a track record at that time.
Mm.
I do now.
Yeah.
So it's easier for people to believe. Believe me now.
Absolutely.
No faith is required right now.
Absolutely. That's actually a key. I like your strategy in going after kind of like the worst places. As crazy as it sounds, I think that that's where you find the most value. That's kind of how I invest in stocks. It's like I want to go after what's been beaten down the most because that's usually what you can get for under the actual price that it's really worth. Is that still what you do? Do you kind of like?
Well, that's still what I recommend. I'm transitioning what I do for real estate wise, but let me develop that point a little bit about it being beaten down. It depends on how it's beaten down.
Mm.
If it's beaten down with a bad reputation,
mm-hmm.
then absolutely. If it's beaten down because of something that's real versus something that's
perceived,
perceived, then you got to really make sure you differentiate that.
Got it.
And also in the book, I really wanted to, I probably would have written more on it. You need the police department to be in the right frame, mental frame, so that they're a partner with you.
Yeah, yeah.
As well as the politicians. Once you get all three of those together, and you're on the fringe, not in the heart of the ghetto, but right on the fringe of it, where you can see the visual cues. You know, you can see the good neighborhood, the quote unquote fabric. You know, I call it the fabric, the fringe, and the fray.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to be in the fray. You want to be right on the fringe where you can see the fabric.
Yeah, I like that. That was one of the things that I pulled out that was awesome. I was like, wow, it's like you still kind of benefit from the negative press, but you're not in the middle of the negative press so that you can still associate yourself.
You got it, man. You really got it. That's exactly it. And then you take care of the PR issue, just like, you know, when our president says something, there's a bunch of people come out and try to clean it up for him.
Yeah. Like Chicago.
Or anytime any celebrity does something, they have a whole PR campaign to clean it up. If you don't do that, if you don't give people new information so that they can make a new decision, you know, tell them that they went into rehab, you know, and he's born again, and he's done so many hours of community service. And you know, if you don't give people new information, then they can't form a new decision.
That's an amazing point. So it's like you kind of have to combat the bad news with good news.
You have to get the good news out of the neighborhood. You can't just circulate the good news in the neighborhood. It has to go out of the neighborhood into the magazines, you know, that last 5 minutes of the local news where they're talking about cat stories or whatever. You want to get all those feel good. You want to plant them in there and actively campaign to get the good news out of the neighborhood, so people out of the neighborhood can have something else to think about.
Nice. So can you tell us about the 8 unit? You said it was in one of the worst parts of that town. Are you still own that one, and how has that process kind of shaped itself?
So I still own it. I'm getting ready to do another block party on August 1st. Mm-hmm. This will be our 7th National Night Out block party,
which is important.
Is critical.
can you tell people why that's important?
It's important because that's a whole hour talk. It's important because any bad elements need to know that they're not in charge.
Mm.
That people are going to have open discussions right in the middle of the street, and we're not afraid to communicate with each other, and that we know who we know each other, and we you know it's important to invite the police as your guests to mingle with you, to eat hot dogs with you, play a few games with you. So we have police and fire department show up allow politicians to get their photo ops in.
Wow.
And it's important it's done right in the middle of the street. It signifies all kinds of things of being unafraid. And you know, that no snitching type of mindset, it keeps people in prison. Self-imprisonment, if you follow that non-snitching, which is part of the drug and gang culture.
Mm-hmm.
So once it shuts that down, and over the years, it has made people that were dealing drugs realize that they didn't have a future on our block.
Nice.
It was easier to go elsewhere.
Yeah,
these people are going to be holding hands and singing "Kumbaya" with the police, I might as well up and move because you know. I can't intimidate these guys.
That's cool.
It's easier to intimidate other people. And also the pride for, you know, people long for belongingness. They really do. That's why people join gangs. That's why all the golf clubs and on all economic levels. So making people feel that they belong to your street is critical as far for their pride. You know, if you ever want them to walk by a McDonald's wrapper on the ground and pick it up, you know, have that sense of pride. You know, that's what it's based on. They're proud of their neighborhood. That's just not what we do on this block. It's simple in a quote unquote prestigious neighborhood. You know, if a piece of trash is on the ground, it's going to get picked up by one of the residents. It's you're not going to walk past it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's silly even talking about it, but that piece of litter will stay there if someone doesn't feel they have any ownership to the neighborhood.
I think what's really cool, and in your book you mentioned that a lot of times as the landlord, you'll be the person who will exemplify those behaviors. And so you'll pick up the trash, or you'll speak to the neighbors, or you'll make sure that, like, you show them how to do it.
That's right. You show them how to do it. Because you need to show them what the next stage is, even though they may not be in that next stage. Hmm. You know, you need to have that tension on their behavior moving forward. Yeah. You know, we speak to each other. We say good morning to each other. We have eye contact with each other. Yeah. we if we know someone is ill, we take them a card, or especially if something bad happens in the neighborhood, if there's a drive-by or if there's a someone's injured, you know, you express, those are the times to come out and see if you can help. Is what can I do? You know, can I leave some gift cards around for the local pizza place? Those are the times, you know, where a $10 gift will take care of it. For example, this one fellow had his little dogs. They were relieving themselves in my yard, you know. And it would have been I clean up after it, and it's just it still bothers me today that he allowed his dogs to not pick up after his dogs. When his wife died, and I brought flowers over, it was like $16. That was the end of the dog dropping. My dog dropping pickup days. I took care of it.
Nice. Another thing that I really pulled out of your book, and hopefully you can expand on this, is the idea that landlords working together with other landlords. And a lot of times when you propose an idea to somebody for an investment opportunity, they'll say, well, we'd have to buy the entire block. And, like, that's partly true, but the other landlords have a vested interest in improving that neighborhood as well. So it's like you create kind of like an alliance with other landlords, and then you guys can work together to clean up or work on getting a problem tenant evicted who's making it bad for the entire neighborhood or something along those lines. Is that something you still do, or is that not even necessary anymore?
It's not even necessary anymore, but you definitely got the point, is that if there's any financial investment needed or any energy needed, you don't rely on the residents, the homeowners to do it. You rely on the landlords who see it in their self. It's all about self-interest. Mm-hmm. They see it in their self-interest to make it happen. And they're absolutely willing to help you out. They just don't want to lead the issue. They don't want to lead the effort.
Yeah.
So what holds these neighborhoods back, troubled neighborhoods back, is a lack of leadership. No one wanting to, especially landlords, exercise leadership.
Wow.
That's what holds it all back.
Interesting. Very interesting. All right, so I'm going to fire off a few quick questions, and then
all right,
we'll wrap this
up. Bring it.
So, what struggles have you overcome, and how did you overcome them?
You know, once I clicked in that I needed to make sure I didn't put myself at risk. You know, That's that whole idea of being a catalyst. Mm-hmm. That was instrumental. That made sure I don't need to show up at 1 o'clock in the morning to check on things, or I don't need to walk into the middle of something that looks like it's going sideways. Yeah. So that was important, and also being effective. It's kind of why I like that catalyst analogy so much. I was deploying myself, or I was using my time in meetings that were going nowhere. You know, that's not how you should. It doesn't. You don't deploy your leadership until things are ready. You know, if people have this a lot of dissatisfaction and just keep circulating their dissatisfaction with no plan and no vision of what it's going to look like, then it's not going to go anywhere. But once the dissatisfaction, a vision of what things could look like, and a basic plan is there, then you can jump in and exercise your leadership and be a part of those making that happen. Then you can affect, but there's no need to be in every single neighborhood association meeting and stress your family out at home. You know, there's no need to do that.
What was your best deal?
My best deal was that first deal. Since then, I went on to have some other good deals, and then lose money, because that's part of it. Part of making sure, you know, once you go through the cycle of making money and then losing money and then coming back from that, then you're kind of a mature investor. Otherwise, you think that you're God's gift and that you're always hitting home runs, you know. Mm-hmm. So the first deal was effortless because other people were making the neighborhood better, and I was on the ride with for it. And then, this apex of getting it. So, you know, it was a $340,000 investment at the time. And my cash, there's nothing that meets the cash flow now, but you know, it's if you were just looking at the numbers, it'd be over $1 million investment now.
So when you say $1 million investment, did you pay for the property in cash, or did you finance it and then rehab it?
Yeah, I financed it when I bought it years ago. Mm-hmm. And you can't over-improve. There's no sense of putting in the best things until people that can pay for the best things are there.
Nice.
But you do want to keep it well-groomed and do what you can as you're going. You want to leave the neighborhood, but you don't want to overextend yourself, because mm-hmm. there's no profit in that.
Yeah. Interesting. So in our search for some deals, we've come across some properties where there was like a murder in the neighborhood, or like even a murder on the front steps. So mm-hmm. is that something that would turn you off, or is that something you still try to push through?
That's something you go for.
Really?
That's the time. That's when you get your prices lowest.
Wow.
Yeah, I'd be right there for that.
And do you have to disclose that to potential tenants? Do you have to say, well, this happened 6 months ago? Or?
Yeah, you should absolutely do that.
Mm-hmm.
You'd have to do that if you're selling. Absolutely. But it's just a matter of integrity for, you would want to know.
Yeah, and you don't want them to find out later, and then they're like, why didn't you tell me this? And they're suing you, so.
Oh, yeah, that not only suing you,
yep.
That wouldn't be my concern. It's just the breach in trust.
The brand, yeah.
And the, this, you know how it is with us in respect. it's just a lack of courtesy and mm-hmm. of, the, you know, let you know what you're getting into. But there's a lot of things that you can do when that happens. That family moves on, and that means that neighborhood's in that cycle, you know, that circular cycle of people making promises and being disappointed, more promises and disappointments. So again, it's a lack of leadership to help people over that.
Nice.
I'd be right there for that. That's awesome. I'd be buying that property up if it as soon as it hit the market.
That's so crazy. And I think that it's because, I mean, with stocks, I get it. I mean, I've been in stocks for some time, and so I know bad news means let's get it. But with real estate, I'm like, man.
Because, well, I mean, now there's a plan. There's a plan to that is proven to transition that your asset.
Yeah.
You know, now, without that plan in place, it was scary. You know.
Yeah.
When I was putting it together, I couldn't find anything. So, that roadmap.
Mm-hmm.
Now that there's a roadmap, then it's still scary, but there's some structure around it.
Nice. So I have a question. If you come across a property, say the property is priced at $100,000, and everybody's offloading their properties or offloading their assets around, like the comps justified at $100,000, but the property needs like $15,000, $20,000 worth of work, which would put you in at about $120,000, how do you justify paying more than the market? Is it just something you'd walk away from, or is it still something that you can work with if the cash flow makes sense?
Excuse me. You know, in the current climate with banks and everything, they're going to be looking at their appraisers, what the appraiser does, what the appraiser says.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like there's no, if we're talking, we're not talking inner city anymore. We're just talking a regular investment.
It's borderline inner city.
Well, you want that property to be smeared with some type of bad vibes on it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you want it to be labeled in the ghetto.
Interesting.
When you buy it,
that's so cool.
So you want to embrace that label, and then if you're a Bible scholar, you know, you change the name after you own it.
Yeah. Wow. Do you have a source for that so I can search that scripture?
I'll have to get it to you. I don't have it memorized, but, the Apostle Paul has done it, and Saul.
Yeah. I'm really big on names. I think the names are important. So, I mean, you just confirmed that.
Yeah. That's really key. You see it done on all kinds of levels, what people call things.
Mm.
You saw it done. Now, take this with the right mind. Mm-hmm. You saw it done brilliantly through the last presidential campaign.
Absolutely.
Of labeling people.
Absolutely. Crooked Hillary. So it's like, that's all you see her through is that lens of being crooked.
And staying with it.
Yeah.
You know, staying consistent on the label that you gave them.
It's like, wow, that's awesome. Very cool. All right, a few more questions.
So we got to harvest that. We got to harvest those lessons and use it for good.
Yeah, absolutely. So what advice do you have? What one piece of advice do you have for new investors?
It depends on, you're talking about African-American investors?
Sure.
Yeah, or just investors in general?
Our market, for the most part, with the club that I run and the people that I kind of have following me, is African-American. So yeah, let's go there.
Oh man, there's so much I want to share with you guys on that. One thing is it's a larger discussion, but we do a lot of stuff for status, and we don't work with each other because of losing status, and we don't follow each other because we don't want to cooperate with each other because somehow it reduces our status if we cooperate with Charles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we got to get past that. Got to get past that. So that's a whole long conversation about that. So once the ego is checked and kind of in a spot where you can build wealth, kind of a wealth building ego, of is almost delayed gratification. Then, you know, using our strengths, if we were raised in a certain neighborhood that we know the ins and outs, all the cracks, we know all the people we went to high school with and their properties, that is a good place to start. As far as that's where the advantage is, right?
Mm-hmm.
There.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Lisa Phillips actually said the same exact thing, is using what can be perceived as a disadvantage as an advantage. And so it's like, where other people are scared of those neighborhoods, you might be able to navigate that same exact neighborhood just by your, quote, street smarts. So use your street
smarts.
That's
right.
Yeah.
It's that knowledge is power. You got the knowledge of who's and the relationships right there. That's where you take off. And then, you know, I talk about in the book unburdening a neighborhood and let it have the right buoyant, restore its buoyancy. So those are all the things you can do and actually make it happen versus throw a lot of money into it and it not happening.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Any other points you want to make there?
Oh, there's so much, you know, I'm locking up in my mental mind, it's not that, like you were saying earlier, you guys don't have the funds yet, but you do, because all your partners have 401ks, and it's just a matter of working together,
mm-hmm.
in a way that you stay together, and you know, that type of resourcefulness. Also asking the question, you know, the rich dad poor dad question of how can we do this? What do we need to do to make this happen?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the mindset you want to come in at. And not back away from anything.
Absolutely. Especially when we can spot all these deals in LA that just makes perfect sense. It's like we're backing away from deals that we could be dunking and then just waiting for the market to turn around, or participating in the turnaround, facilitating the turnaround.
You know, that's one of my sore spots is folks that see it, have the ability and the talents and the God-given gifts to do it, but not doing it because of they don't have the resources by themselves, and then first ones to complain about it and to pick it and to
absolutely.
You know, woe is me, and outside forces are limiting my prosperity when there's nothing further from the truth in my mind,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know?
Absolutely. So what is your favorite book? Not real estate book, not business book, just book in general.
Oh, well, we'll start with the Bible then.
All right.
but going from there, have you heard of John Maxwell?
John C. Maxwell, yep.
Yeah. Everything he writes, you should read it.
And he writes pretty short books too, right?
Yeah, but they're just like, every sentence is just drips of wisdom.
All right.
So I like John Maxwell.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the cash flow quadrant.
Mm-hmm.
Just having that mindset of, I'm spending my money. Is this an asset or is this a liability?
Yeah.
And just focus on trying to buy more assets.
Yeah.
And just, you know, how am I spending my money? That should always be, you know, I drive a 11-year-old Prius,
mm-hmm.
that people laughed at me, couldn't pronounce the name of it when I bought it, mm-hmm. and laughed at the shape of it. But, you know, gas has gone to $4.50 over the course of the 10 years, you know, per gallon.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, I have to buy something. I want to make it as much of an asset as I can.
Nice. Nice. That's awesome. I've never even considered that. It's like you can acquire a liability and still try to finesse it to the fact, to like in a way that it serves you.
Right. That's so exactly it.
That is awesome. That is really cool. Because, I mean, a lot of times people have bright lines. Like you say, oh, it's either an asset or a liability. Well, yes, but if it's a liability, but you can Airbnb the second bedroom, or you can Airbnb whatever, then it can serve you and it can still bring income into your life. So it's not a complete write-off. It's not a complete loss. That's really cool.
Right.
That's
right. Really cool. You still can hot rod it.
I've never even considered that. Wow.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
There you go, bro.
I'm glad I could share that with you.
Yeah.
I'm glad I could share that one with you.
That was cool. All right. Two questions. What does wealth mean to you?
Uh-oh, Dilucia?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Okay, I can now. Yeah.
Yeah, I said, what does wealth mean to you?
You know, I was thinking about that question, and it really means I can control my time mm-hmm. now. Now that there's enough to, I can be home during the day with my family instead of having to drive commute to work. You know,
mm-hmm.
just having that control of my time, or there's no one telling me where I have to be at a certain spot, or that type of thing, or you know, the thing I didn't like the most about corporate world was those annual evaluations.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no more of those.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of the evaluations.
No, I'm not a fan of people telling me, giving me a raise and things like that.
Yeah.
You know, that's what I do. I give myself a raise.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I don't even like that whole discussion. Never sat right with me.
Yeah.
So, yeah, time and you know, during those evaluations, they say, what's your 5-year plan? And I would always be trying not to say it, but I'm always saying, I'm be out of here, you know, working for myself. There is no 5-year plan with you and I.
Yeah, that's funny.
So that's really it.
Yeah.
Controlling my time is really it.
So what do you do for fun?
Wow. As a landlord scientist, it's all fun.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because I'm experimenting, and I always wanted to be an inventor. So this kind of tinkering with ideas and coming up with different things is a lot of fun, you know. And raising the family is a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and reading, you know, you sound like you're a book person too.
Definitely.
It doesn't look like you're doing anything, but it's a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Just being a learner is a lot of fun.
Yeah. Cool. Last question is just, where can people learn more about you?
Well, the best place, I keep a kind of a collection of all the things I'm thinking about and all the different writings and where I'm speaking different things on leadinglandlord.com. That's my main website. It's leadinglandlord.com.
Okay. Very cool.
Yeah.
It's funny because I was on Twitter one day and somebody was asking me, like, oh, did you watch Al Williamson's, like, you're doing a webinar. And I thought that I was, like, super in tune, because when I find somebody that kind of is doing what I want to do, I tend to kind of, like, try to link up with them in whatever I can do. I did that with Lisa Phillips in her email thread. I didn't know that you had that, though, so I'm definitely going to get linked up. Anybody listening should definitely get linked up. You're doing some great work. You're doing work that I think that all of us can and should be doing. And I'm just grateful that you took your time to share your story, share your experiences with our audience. So I appreciate that. Is there anything else you want to leave us with before you go?
No, that's my pleasure. I'm happy to help people along. I don't want to I want to pour it all out while I have it.
Absolutely.
While I have my faculties.
All right.
Hey, thanks for having me.
No problem. So this has been another episode of the Todd Capital Millionaire Podcast. If you would like to join either of our clubs, email us at info@capitaltodd.com. We also have more information at the website, which is capitaltodd.com. This is episode 25.